Welcome to IP Management Voice, the podcast spotlighting leading minds in IP and IP management. This series supports the IP Business Academy's call for subject matter experts to share insights, foster reflection, and strengthen the global IP system. Join the conversation via our newsletter and explore cutting-edge content on DPLEX. The content featured in this episode on IP awareness training for corporate in-house functions comes from Farnaz Masumian.
I want you to picture something for a second. When I say the words intellectual property or, you know, IP, what is the very first image that pops into your head? Be honest.
Oh, I bet I know. It's probably a dusty filing cabinet in a basement somewhere.
Right. Or maybe a room full of lawyers in really expensive suits, just arguing over the fine print of a document that nobody else understands.
Yeah, that's the classic image. It's kind of the eat your vegetables view of the corporate world. People see it as this necessary evil, like boring paperwork you just have to get through so you don't get sued.
Exactly. But for today's deep dive, we are going to completely flip that script. We're unpacking a framework that argues IP isn't just paperwork, it is actually the lifeblood of innovation.
It really is. It's a massive strategic asset.
Right, an asset that can literally make or break a company's future. And to guide us through this, we were looking at the work of Farnaz Masumian.
Yes, she's a patent attorney at Vodafone Group in the UK.
And she's developed this really incredible approach to what she calls awareness building for IP in in-house settings.
Which is such a critical topic. And what I think makes her approach so refreshing is that she just flat out rejects the idea of one-size-fits-all training.
Yes. She's basically saying, you know, stop dragging everyone into the exact same boring lecture.
That's the core of her whole philosophy right there. I mean, if you try to teach a software developer about IP the exact same way you teach a CEO, you are going to lose both of them immediately.
You have to tailor the message.
Exactly. You have to tailor it. It's about moving away from those dry lectures filled with legal jargon and moving toward compelling narratives.
Storytelling over slide decks.
Yeah.
I love that concept. But let's be real for a second. How do you actually make patent law a compelling narrative? It sounds like a really hard sell.
It does sound tough, but it starts with empathy. Farnaz talks about starting with the end in mind. So before you even design a training session, you have to ask yourself, what do I want this specific person to actually do after this session?
Right, because you aren't trying to make them a lawyer.
Exactly. You're trying to give them a toolkit for their specific job.
Don't just dump information on them. Give them a mission. So let's unpack this framework, because she breaks it down nicely by who she is talking to. And I want to start right at the top. The senior leaders.
C-suite.
Yes. So if I'm an IP expert walking into a boardroom to talk to the CEO, I'm guessing I shouldn't start reading them the nuances of patent claim drafting.
Definitely not. If you start talking about claim construction or filing dates, their eyes will completely glaze over. They don't need to know how to draft a claim.
They need to know how it impacts the bottom line.
Precisely. For senior leaders, the narrative has to be about business strategy. You have to connect the IP to revenue, to market position, and of course, to risk.
So it's a lot less here is a law and much more here is how we beat the competition.
Yeah, Farnaz suggests showing them the competitive landscape. Show them exactly how their rivals are using IP to block market entry.
Oh, that's smart.
Right, because if you can show a leader that a competitor is using patents to fence off a really profitable part of the market, you instantly have their attention.
It's the fear of missing out, or rather the fear of being locked out.
And the risk of naivety, too. There are so many real-world scenarios where companies just didn't pay attention to IP and suffered massive financial or reputational damage.
When you present those case studies where a company lost millions simply because they didn't secure their rights,
yeah,
that creates a real emotional connection.
It stops being abstract legal theory and becomes a harsh business reality.
It's interesting you mention that, because one of the things Masumian points out is that people often think patents are only for, like, crazy sci-fi technology, flying cars and quantum computers. Like, if I'm a CEO of a retail company, do I really care about patents?
That is a huge misconception. And she uses the example of the Amazon one-click patent to dismantle that idea entirely.
Oh, right. That is legendary. But remind me, what was the actual innovation there? Because to me, it just seemed like a button.
It felt like just a button to the user, sure. But it was a highly specific business process. It wasn't a new piece of hardware or a rocket engine. It was a method of reducing friction in the checkout process.
Right.
But that patent gave Amazon a massive competitive advantage for years. It streamlined the user experience in a way that literally no one else could legally copy without permission.
So for a long time, everyone else was stuck using a standard shopping cart model with multiple steps, which, as we know, absolutely kills conversion rates. And that's just because Amazon owned the concept of skipping the cart.
Exactly. And that proves that commercially valuable innovation doesn't have to be high tech in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
It just has to solve a problem and have commercial value.
That makes total sense. And I think she has another example that's a bit more unusual. Something about chefs.
Oh, yeah. The chef's face mask. It sounds really funny, but it's a specific, practical solution to a problem. It's a mask designed to stop chefs from eating the food while they cook.
Wait, really? An anti-snacking mask? That feels like something you'd see on a late-night infomercial.
It really does. But here's the thing. It offers a technical solution to a technical problem. Therefore, it can be patented.
Wow.
Farnaz uses this to show leaders that value can be found in the mundane, not just the moonshots. If it solves a problem that costs your business money, even if that problem is snacking chefs, it's an asset.
That is such a great way to make it relatable. Now, I know Mazumian uses a specific analogy for leaders that I really liked. She compares IP management to a football match.
Yes. This is a brilliant metaphor because it clarifies roles, especially for executives who might just think IP is a background function.
Right.
Think of your different patents, your utility models, your designs as the players on the field. Each player has different strengths and weaknesses. Some are defensive, blocking competitors. Some are offensive, opening up new territories.
And usually the CEO thinks the IP manager is just the referee.
Yeah.
Just making sure the rules are followed.
Exactly. But Farnaz argues that the IP manager is actually the coach. Their job is to decide how to deploy those players, those assets, to win the game. It completely reframes IP from simple compliance to active strategy.
That is a really powerful shift in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Because it puts the onus on the C-suite to actually give the coach the budget to buy good players.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got the leaders on board. They're ready to play to win. Now let's move to the people actually making the stuff, the architects of innovation, the R&D teams.
This is a totally different conversation. For the innovators, the goal is empowering them to spot patentable inventions, but arguably more importantly, teaching them when not to talk.
The danger zone.
Yeah.
I feel like this is where the excitement of invention really clashes with the reality of the law.
It absolutely does. The danger zone is premature disclosure. This is the golden rule. For R&D, do not disclose an invention to a third party without a non-disclosure agreement or NDA before you file the patent.
Because if you just tweet about your cool new invention before you file or present it at a conference,
you have likely destroyed its novelty. And if it's not novel, in most jurisdictions, it cannot be patented. You've essentially just given your invention to the public domain for free.
That is a heartbreaker. Imagine working on something for 2 years, mentioning it at a happy hour, and poof, there goes the patent.
It happens way more often than you'd think, and it's not just about loose lips, it's about deep-seated misconceptions. There are myths R&D teams believe that stop them from even bringing their ideas forward to the legal team in the first place.
Hey, are you an IP expert with a focused topic you want to share? Then you might be just the right fit to become an IP subject matter expert at the IP Business Academy. It's a great opportunity to build visibility for your expertise and reach new clients through a trusted academic platform. You'll be supported in creating digital content, LinkedIn strategies, and outreach to your target group. If you're ready to raise your profile and position yourself as a thought leader, get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. End of advertisement.
Look, what kind of myth?
A big one is the belief that software or AI cannot be patented. You hear this all the time in tech circles. People say, oh, you can't patent code. It's just math.
Is that true? Because I feel like I hear conflicting things about this all the time.
It is not true. I mean, it's nuanced, sure, but as a blanket statement, it's false. If the software provides a technical solution to a technical problem, it can absolutely be patented.
Okay.
Think about image processing or encryption algorithms or how a battery management system works in an EV. That is all software, and it is highly patentable.
So if your engineers are sitting there thinking, oh, this is just code, they might be sitting on million-dollar assets that they assume are worthless.
Exactly. Farnaz emphasizes that you have to dispel these myths early. But then you run into another problem, which is the patent document itself. Have you ever actually tried to read one?
I have. It's like reading a stereo manual written by a frantic lawyer. in the 1800s. It's incredibly dense.
It's so intimidating.
Right.
So how do you get engineers to engage with that? Farnaz uses another great analogy here, the patent as a house.
Okay, walk me through this. How does a patent map to a house?
So imagine the patent specification is the blueprint for a house. You have two main parts. First, the description section. This represents the plan of the house itself. It explains how to build it, what's inside, where the plumbing goes.
Okay, so that's the technical manual, the how-to guide.
Right. But then you have the claims section. This is the legally binding part. The claims represent the boundary of the property, the fence line. They define exactly what you own and what you don't own.
Oh, I see where this is going. So you could have a description that explains how to build a massive mansion.
But if your claims only draw a fence around the garden shed, then you only own the garden shed. Everyone else can read your description, build the mansion, and as long as they don't touch your shed, they aren't infringing.
Wow. That makes it so much more approachable.
Oh.
It helps the engineer understand that their job is the description, but they really need to help the attorney place the fence, the claims, in the exact right spot.
Exactly. It demystifies the document so engineers can actually engage with it rather than just signing some confusing legal form.
Okay, speaking of engineers, let's talk about a specific breed of innovator, the software developers.
Yeah.
Because Mizumian carves them out as a totally separate group from general R&D, right?
Yes, and for very good reason. While general R&D is worried about patenting new things, software developers face a very specific daily challenge, the open source maze.
This is where it gets tricky. I feel like there's a vibe in the coding world that open source just means free stuff I can use however I want, like an all-you-can-eat buffet.
And that is the dangerous misconception. The core message for developers has to be that open source does not mean free of obligation.
Right. It's not a free-for-all. It is a contract.
It is. When you download a library from GitHub, you are agreeing to a license. Farnaz breaks them down generally into two buckets to keep it simple for developers.
Mm-hmm.
You have your permissive licenses like MIT or Apache.
Those are the chill ones.
Pretty chill, yeah. They are flexible. They have minimal restrictions. You can use the code, build on it, put it in a commercial product, and you generally just have to give credit.
Okay.
But then you have the copyleft licenses like the GPL.
The viral ones.
The viral ones. And this is the absolute nightmare scenario for a proprietary software company.
Why do they call it viral, though? That sounds ominous.
Because it infects everything it touches. The philosophy behind copyleft is that software should be free. So the license terms often state that if you use a piece of copyleft code in your product, your derivative work must also be released under the same license.
Wait, let me make sure I've got this right. If I'm a startup building a secret, highly proprietary trading algorithm, and I just copy and paste a library with a strip copyleft license into my code,
the terms of that license could legally force you to reveal your entire source code, your secret trading algorithm, to the world. You have just accidentally open sourced your company's crown jewels.
Yikes. So one copy-paste error could technically destroy the entire business model.
It really could. And that is why developers need to be trained on this. It's not about stopping them from using open source. It's just about using it safely.
But practically speaking, how do you even manage that? A modern app might have thousands of dependencies. You can't ask a developer to read the legal fine print of every single library.
Mizumian mentions software composition analysis tools, or SCA. These are automated scanners.
Oh, like a virus scanner, but for lawyers.
Essentially, yes. It's like a metal detector for risky code. They run through your code base, find all the open source components, and flag the licenses. It gives you a dashboard saying, hey, 99% of this is fine, but this one file right here, it's GPL, remove it or replace it.
That seems like a non-negotiable tool for any modern tech company. It's just basic hygiene.
It really is.
Okay, so we've covered the creators and the strategists, but there is another group we have to talk about. The people shaking hands, signing deals, and bringing in the money. The business teams. Sales. Procurement.
The negotiators. They are right on the front lines. They might not write the patent or the code, but they are the ones agreeing to the contract terms that govern the IP.
And I imagine their relationship with the IP team is somewhat complicated.
Often, yes. Sales teams usually view legal as the department of no. They just want to get the deal done, sign the paper, and hit their quota. But Farnaz argues they need to understand specific clauses so they don't view legal as a blocker, but as a protector. They really need to understand why legal is pushing back.
So what are the big red flags they need to watch for?
The first one is ownership. Who owns the IP created during the contract?
Well, that seems straightforward. If I pay you to do it, I own it.
You would think so, but legally, that's not the default in many places. If you hire a consultant to write code for you and the contract doesn't explicitly say, "We own the output," the consultant might retain the copyright. You paid for it, but they actually own it.
That is a trap waiting to happen.
Yeah.
What about indemnity? That's a word that puts most people to sleep, but I know it's crucial.
It is an insurance policy. Let's say you buy a piece of software from a vendor. You want an indemnity clause that says, if this software infringes on someone else's patent and I get sued, you, the vendor, have to pay for the lawsuit.
Right, that protects you. You broke it, you buy it.
Exactly. But the red flag is the reverse if you are the vendor. A salesperson might be tempted to sign a contract with unlimited indemnity just to close a massive deal. But that means if something goes wrong, you are on the hook for infinite damages. You do not want to bet the entire company on one contract.
So a salesperson needs to know that unlimited indemnity is basically a massive do not sign zone.
Precisely. And then there's confidentiality, and specifically protecting trade secrets. The red flag here is clauses that grant broad rights to your pre-existing IP without compensation.
Is that the background IP issue?
Yes. You see this in partnerships all the time. A partner might try to slip in a clause that says any IP used in this project is shared. Well, if you bring your core pre-existing technology, your background IP, into that project, you might have just accidentally granted them a free license to your absolute best technology.
Sneaky.
Very. And if a salesperson just wants to get the deal done, they might easily gloss over that. That's why training them to spot these issues is so vital. It turns them into a first line of defense.
Okay, so we have these tailored approaches for everyone. Leaders need strategy. Innovators need secrecy. Devs need license hygiene. Business teams need contracts. But how do you actually make it stick? Because people forget things the moment they walk out of the training room.
Right. You can't just have an IP day once a year and expect everyone to remember it. Farnaz is very clear on this. It has to be a constant drumbeat.
Culture building.
Exactly. It's about building an IP savvy culture. This means using internal sites, newsletters, regular updates. But again, you have to keep it tailored.
So in the company newsletter, don't just paste a legal update that says Section 4 has been amended.
No one will read that. Instead, tell the inventors exactly where to submit their new ideas this month. Make the link obvious. Tell the leaders about a recent patent grant and how it added actual value to the business. Tell the developers about a new tool available for checking licenses.
All about relevance. It's about connecting the IP to their daily grind.
It is. When you do this, you move the organization from a compliance mindset, where IP is just a rule to follow or a box to check, to a culture where innovation thrives because people feel safe and empowered to create.
I really like that. It turns IP from a barrier into an enabler. If I know exactly where the guardrails are, I can drive a lot faster.
That's the ultimate goal.
So let's recap this journey, because there is a lot here. It starts with the why, for the leaders connecting IP to strategy and winning the game. Then it moves to the how, for the innovators spotting ideas and keeping them secret until the time is right.
Then the watchouts for the developers navigating the open source maze without getting trapped. And finally, the fine print for the business teams understanding the contracts so they don't accidentally sign away the farm.
And wrapping it all in a culture of constant communication. It really shows that whether you are the CEO or a junior coder, you are part of this ecosystem. You have a role to play.
Absolutely. You can't opt out of the IP ecosystem. You are in it whether you realize it or not. The only question is whether you are navigating it intentionally or just drifting.
Which brings us back to that football analogy.
Yeah.
I think that is a great place to leave you, our listener, with a thought to chew on.
It really is. If you think about your organization right now, look at your team. Are you the coach with a clear game plan, knowing exactly how to use every player on the field? Or are you just kicking the ball around hoping you don't get a red card?
Or worse, hoping the other team doesn't score on you while you're not looking.
Exactly. IP isn't a spectator sport. You have to be on the field.
I love that. Farnaz Mazumian's framework really gives us the playbook for that. It's been fascinating to see how she breaks down what could be a very dry topic into something so human and strategic. Thank you so much for walking us through this deep dive.
It was a pleasure. It's always fun to see the hidden machinery behind how businesses actually work.
And thank you to everyone listening. Now go check your filing cabinets, metaphorically speaking, and see what value you might be hiding away. And maybe double check those open source licenses while you're at it.
Thanks for listening to IP Management Voice. If there's any topic you'd like us to cover in this podcast or on the content platform Dplex, please get in contact and let us know.